This piece was brought to you by the Tabard Inn, tabardinn.com. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Pleasure.
Our gift to you this holiday season is a marvelous mashup of just a few of our favorite things, our most inspiring podcasts. We're bundling up the best moments from Evolutionaries, which features the stories behind the movers, shakers, and makers in food today. This segment features three women who are pulling back the curtain while opening our minds to what's really going on in the food chain. Marion Nessel, Joan Gussow, and Darina Allen. We begin with Marion Nessel, founder of New York University's Food Studies program and author of such award-winning books as Food Politics, Safe Food, and What to Eat. She literally wrote the books on what's wrong with the nation's food system and how we can fix it.
They weren't letting their doctoral students do dissertation projects on food, or if they were doing dissertation projects on food issues, they weren't treated very well. Oh, has that changed? Now, everybody is doing projects on food issues. I can't keep up with them. And the issues are important. You know, if you change somebody's diet, you're making them healthier. If you change the way food is produced, you're changing the environment. These are not trivial issues.
Heritage Radio Network proudly presents Evolutionaries. Marion Nessel. Marion Nessel is one of the leading food educators in modern history, a pioneer in the food studies movement who has changed the lives of thousands through her teachings. She's a consumer activist, nutritionist, award-winning author, and academic who specializes in the politics of food and dietary choice. Marion Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, in the very department that she chaired from 1988 through 2003. Her academic journey started in UC Berkeley in 1954, but something happened to her as a child that would change her forever.
Where I learned about food was at a summer camp in Vermont. I was sent to a summer camp in Vermont that was run by a woman who had lived in China for a great deal of her life, and was a fabulous upscale Chinese cook. And this camp was on a farm in southern Vermont, and there was a very, very large vegetable garden. And if you were a good camper, and as a privilege, you could go out and pick the vegetables for the night's dinner. And I remember, I still remember going out to the garden one night and picking green beans and biting into one. And it must have been July, and it was still hot from the sun. And it was the most extraordinary taste and texture. I mean, I've never forgotten it. It was just amazing. Never tasted anything like that before. All of the green beans that I had ever eaten were cooked to death, canned, heavily salted. And, you know, they'd been murdered. And here was this absolutely delicious crisp. I could just not stop eating them. And we had berries, you know, vast fields of berries and wild berries growing in the hills. And the woman who ran the camp would take those and make blueberry pancakes or raspberry pancakes or something like that. They also had a sugaring off place, and you could go up there during the winter and have real maple syrup. I mean, these were things that I had never tasted before. I thought they were wonderful. And I knew I was interested in food, that there was something about it that was just extraordinarily attractive and pleasurable. And my mother had a friend who collected cookbooks, which, of course, everybody was very contemptuous of the time. She had an enormous collection of cookbooks. Oh, how I wish I knew what happened to that collection and how I regret not acquiring it. But when I went to Berkeley, I wanted to study food, but there were two options. One was agriculture, and I was a city girl. I didn't get agriculture at all at the time. Oh, and the other was dietetics, and I signed up as a dietetic major at Berkeley. I lasted exactly one day, and that was the end of that. I ended up getting a degree in bacteriology because I was interested in science. I was in a chemistry class on my first day at Berkeley, and I liked it and was interested in science. And at one point, I did some calculations, and I was tired of school and I wanted to finish and I could graduate quickest in bacteriology. So I did. And then went to work for a couple of years. I was married. I had kids. And then I went back to graduate school in molecular biology. Yeah, I was in graduate school in the early 60s at Berkeley. It was during the Vietnam War, and it was during the free speech movement. And I was actively engaged in it in the sense that I was enormously sympathetic. My husband at the time was a lawyer for the arrested students during the free speech movement. But I had two small children. And I understood for the first time why women were rarely revolutionaries, because who was going to take care of my kids if I got arrested? There was no question that I could not be arrested and that I had to stay out of that kind of trouble. So I did. And I went to meetings and I went to rallies and I often brought the children to things that they probably shouldn't have been brought to. But they were too young to complain.
Having completed her BA in bacteriology and her PhD in molecular biology at UC Berkeley by 1968, Marion Nestle found herself looking for the next chapter in her life. In 1976, she was hired as Associate Dean for Human Biology and taught nutrition at the UCSF School of Medicine. It wasn't until she lost her job that she decided to make a career-defining transition and work towards an MPH from UC Berkeley in public health nutrition.
I lost my job at UCSF. I mean, I was basically fired. A new dean came in and wanted to bring his own staff. And I was the only, I was then an associate dean at the medical school in San Francisco, and I was the only one of the senior administrators who didn't have tenure. So I was in really big trouble, and I was going to have to find another job, and I didn't know what to do. And everybody said, well, you can't teach nutrition. You don't have credentials for it. So somebody advised me to go get credentials in nutrition, and the easiest way to do that would be to get a master's in public health. And it wasn't just that it was the easiest way, it was also the way that made the most sense, because when I looked back over my career at that point, I could see that I was doing public health. And when I read the public health journals, I could see that the jobs that were available to people with master's in public health degrees were just exactly the kind of work that I would want to do. So I went to the University of California in Berkeley and did a one-year MPH and had a wonderful time. It was a great thing to do. I mean, I didn't really think I needed an additional degree, but there was no question that this opened doors, and I was promised that it would open doors. Didn't really believe it. But the kinds of things that you do in public health school get you out in the world, and you meet people, and you find out what's going on, and you find out what you like to do. And as part of that degree program, we were required to do a 10-week internship with some public health agency, and I asked the Agency for International Development if I could be considered for jobs when I finished the MPH. And they said, you don't have any international experience. And I said, well, how about some international experience? And they said, okay, we can do that. We need somebody to go to Southeast Asia to do a project, and maybe we'll just send you to that. And they did. So I spent the summer after my MPH coursework in Southeast Asia doing an investigation on urban malnutrition in Bangkok and Jakarta, and I also taught a course in China that summer. It was really a terrific thing to do, and as part of all the negotiations about all that, I had arranged to go to Washington the following year to work in the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. They were looking for somebody with an MPH who knew something about public health, who knew something about nutrition, and who could help with the editing of a report that was in very big trouble called the Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. It had just gone through three or four project officers, eaten them alive, and they needed somebody who could bring that report to completion. And I had just finished writing a book about nutrition for medical students. I'd reviewed everything. I could have written that whole thing myself and practically did.
3 degrees and a government job later, Marion had a pretty deep understanding of the way food, nutrition, and health worked in this country. But she still hadn't found the right outlet for her work. Luckily, she answered a call from NYU that wouldn't only change her life, but the lives of generations of students to come.
NYU is the only job I got. I mean, I was looking for jobs in New York for almost 2 years. And everybody I knew that I was looking for jobs in New York. And when the NYU position was advertised, it was chair of home economics at the time, I think probably 30 people sent me copies of the ad with little notes on it saying, "Marion's, here's your job." And so I applied for it and got it. What happened in the department at NYU is in general what happened to NYU over that period. I've been lucky enough to be there during a period of rapid growth, rapid development, and much of it for the better. When I started out, the department was home economics and nutrition. It was a small department with a few faculty, a lot of students, 35 degree programs being run by 5 faculty. We ended up closing the 25 home economics programs. Many of them had only 1 or 2 students in them. The department's facilities were in 2 different buildings and were very shabby. The department had been neglected for a very long time. It had a teaching kitchen that was, how can I put this, dirty, and needed a great deal of work. It was very difficult for me at first to figure out where to even start on improving the curriculum, professionalizing the department, and cleaning up the kitchen. I had a pretty good idea in 1995 when we first started working on it that this was something that would work. I had been traveling with a group called Old Ways Preservation and Exchange Trust and going to a lot of meetings in a lot of wonderful places with wonderful people who were interested in food. And I could see that there was an enormous interest in studying about food and that there were very few places to do that. I knew that Boston University had a master's program in gastronomy. I didn't think that would work for NYU. We needed something more rigorously academic. And we had a lucky break. A program in our department in food management was taken away from us and moved into the School of Continuing Education at NYU. That was a program that generated about $1 million a year in student tuition revenue. Everybody was feeling really sorry for us for the loss. And so when the dean told me that this was going to be moved and there was really nothing that she or I could do about it, she said, "How do you feel about it?" I said, "It depends on what I get." And she said, "Well, what do you want?" I said, "I want food studies." And she was a little shocked by that and said she felt it was very, very risky. And if we could have a plan B so that if it didn't work out, we wouldn't be putting a faculty member in grave risk for coming to lead up this program, she would go for it. And she went for it. And when the program was approved by the state in the summer of 1996, the New York Times wrote about it the next week. And we had students in our office that afternoon holding copies of the clipping saying, "I've waited all my life for this program." We knew we had a hit. And now, of course, everybody has them.
Marion didn't stop in the classroom. Over her career, she has published a handful of groundbreaking books, perhaps the most popular being Food Politics, which was published in 2002.
Yeah, Food Politics was the first book that I wrote that got attention, and its genesis went back 10 or 15 years. In the early 1990s, I went to a meeting at the National Cancer Institute that was headed up by then Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. Actually, he had just been fired. And he was no longer Surgeon General, but he was still quite active in the public health arena. And he chaired a meeting at the National Cancer Institute on behavioral causes of cancer. And there were 2 behavioral causes that were discussed at that meeting. One was cigarette smoking, and the other was dietary factors. And Jane Brody from the New York Times and I were the 2 speakers on diet. Everybody else was cigarettes. And I had never heard the anti-cigarette advocates speak about cigarettes before. I certainly knew that cigarettes were bad for health and smoking was bad for health and that you weren't supposed to smoke. And I knew that cigarette companies did evil things. But I had never really examined their marketing in any systematic way. And at this meeting, one they were all physicians. One physician after another showed slides. This was before PowerPoint. So they were showing slides of representations of cigarette marketing in the most amazing places, the jungles of Africa, the remote villages in the high Himalayas, places all over the world. They were showing pictures of the way cigarettes were marketed. And I thought that was amazing. And then physician John Pierce, who's a cancer researcher at the University of California, San Diego, gave a talk on food marketing to children. And this one just took my breath away because he showed slide after slide after slide of Joe Camel and other ways in which cigarettes were marketed to children at that time. And it wasn't that I wasn't aware of Joe Camel or cigarette marketing to children. I had certainly seen it before, but I had never paid any attention to it. It was completely below my radar. And of course, it was supposed to be below my radar. And I walked out of his talk thinking, we should be doing this for Coca-Cola. This is exactly what Coca-Cola does. And I started paying attention. And so paying attention led to a series of professional articles written in professional journals on a whole series of issues related to marketing of foods to children. And in the late 1990s, when I had a sabbatical coming up and I needed a sabbatical project, I had figured out by then that NYU valued books in its academic people very highly. I didn't have a book. I needed a book. And I thought, well, I would take those articles, and in my sabbatical year, I could throw them together into a book, and that would solve the book problem, and it would probably be a good thing to do. And, of course, it took more than a year, but that's what I did. And that book ended up not only as food politics, but because I hadn't realized how much I'd written, it ended up also as Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, a book that came out the following year. So that sabbatical project ended up as two books.
Almost 50 years after starting her academic career, Marion had started to see real change in the way Americans eat and think about food and nutrition. However, she started to notice that too many people in America were focusing on themselves instead of society at large, and that was partially due to the increasing influence of corporations.
At least at this stage in our history, we don't seem to be very concerned about taking care of everybody or taking care of our society as a whole, and we're very divided about whether it's the responsibility of government to do that or whether it isn't. And one result of that kind of attitude is an acceptance of the role of corporations in our life that is not necessarily the way that people in other countries view corporations. We forget that corporations are not social service agencies. And it's very easy to forget that because they are so deeply integrated into every aspect of American life. You know, when you start paying attention, you're overwhelmed by it. And this carries out to the way we regulate food safety. It's okay for people to produce technological innovations without really testing them very extensively, because let's wait and see if they cause trouble. They're probably okay. Let's see if they cause trouble, and then if they cause trouble, we'll deal with it. That's very different from the precautionary principle that's followed by a lot of other governments, where let's test first and make sure they're not harmful and then let them out. But that's the society that we live in. That's what we have to deal with. And for the food movement to operate, we can either try to change that society, or work within it and try to do the best we can within it. That's the challenge for change agents and for people who are trying to change it. This is what we're up against. We're up against a very individualistic, anti-social in some way, society. And the big challenge is, how do you fix that? How do you convince people that taking care of the poor is going to be good for everybody, not just the poor? And it's not going to be taking things away from them. It's ultimately going to make for a much healthier, richer, and more productive society. My dietary advice is really simple, and I follow it. And it doesn't require, I'm totally unselfconscious about it. I mean, my dietary advice is eat what you like, make sure you eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, don't eat too much junk food, enjoy what you're eating, and just don't eat too much. And that's what I do. And that doesn't require any kind of thinking. I mean, I just sort of do it automatically. I'm so astounded when people are embarrassed about eating in front of me. I don't care what they eat. You know, I do nutrition for populations, and one person is not going to statistically change the way the population eats. I never make comments about what people eat. I think that's their personal business. I, you know, would only comment on it if asked. And I expect people not to comment on what I eat. I'm always surprised when people say, "You eat that?" Well, yes, I like desserts. I like pizza. I like what everybody else likes. I like eating in nice restaurants. I just try not to eat too much.
Marion currently writes the Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs at foodpolitics.com and for the Atlantic Food Channel. She's now currently the chair of the Council on Nutrition Policy of the National Association for Public Health Policy. And to this day, she continues to teach as a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU.
Well, I'm teaching a course at NYU in food advocacy right now, and that course is in direct response to the question, how can I get involved? What can I do? I want to do something to improve food production or consumption. How do I do it? And that's what this course is about. I start by suggesting that people find organizations who are working on the same kind of issues that they are and start moving up through those organizations. There's no lack of things to do. We still have a food system that isn't fair, that isn't just, and that isn't healthy, and that needs to change. And if they're not going to change it, who's going to change it? Well, if I thought it was bleak, I would go home and put a blanket over my head and not teach. I don't think it's bleak at all. First of all, I can see the difference that the food movement has made. All you have to do is go into a supermarket and you can see the difference. They didn't have the kind of foods that are available now. There weren't 20 years ago the number of farmers markets that there are now, or CSAs, or young people going into farming, or restaurants that are serving local, artisanal, whatever, whatever, or people producing food products of the kind of quality that they are now, or the number of programs at universities, or the number of students who are interested, or the number of books. I mean, there are so many different objective measures of change. It kind of takes my breath away. I think it's hard for people when you're in the middle of it to see what the change was if you don't have photographs, or if you don't have some kind of memory device fixed of what it used to look like. The changes have been profound, and they're enormously exciting changes, and they're for the better. With that said, there's still plenty to do, and there's still plenty for young people to do, so this is a great thing to get involved in. You don't think you can do something about the war in Afghanistan or climate change? Get involved in the food movement. You can make somebody's life much better. People ask me, well, where should we start? I say start with schools. What's going on in schools is incredible. I mean, it isn't only the federal changes that have been made. It's on the ground, people who are cooking in schools and making healthier foods for kids. If you change the diets at schools and get kids interested in cooking and kids interested in what they're eating, those kids are going to grow up to be healthier adults. I mean, those are important changes. So I'm enormously optimistic about the possibility for making change. The challenge is to make that change reach the people who need it most. That's a big challenge. But it's not going to happen if you don't start someplace.
When she's not busy changing the world, Marion Nessel splits her time between New York City and Ithaca with her partner and can be found enjoying fresh produce from her garden and continuing to inspire students that are just like her. This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org with additional research by Leah Eden. In order of appearance, the songs used in this piece are Cry For Me by the California Honey Drops, Vroom Vroom by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Olympia by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Beast in Air, Beast in Water by Snowmine, Dues Paid by Rectech, Coyote by Brothers NYC, Trial and Error by Snowmine, and once again, Cry For Me by the California Honey Drops.
Next up is Joan Gussow. a celebrated homesteader who currently lives and grows organic produce on the west bank of the Hudson River, Joan Gussow is a professor, author, food policy expert, environmentalist, and gardener. She is considered the matriarch of the food movement and is still defining what it means to eat locally while thinking globally.
To have a garden is to have a future, and to have a future is to be alive. I really, really, really find being in the garden to be deeply calming, particularly with the internet and email and, you know, to come home as I did from Boulder and have 209 emails. It's like hideous, you know, and you could go crazy. But you just go out in the garden and you do stupid things, like I'm weeding grass out of the clover, right? If you have a goal which you expect to achieve in your lifetime, it's too small a goal. And I feel very touched by the fact that when I first came up with the notion of eating locally, which was in the 70s, on a purely theoretical basis, I came to that conclusion, not knowing how to do it. It didn't seem possible, but it seemed we had to do it. It's accepted now that maybe it's expensive, maybe it's not serving all the poor. You know, there's all these things about it's not working, or it's not going to solve the problem, or you're not taking care of the farmers in the middle, as Wes Jackson would say. But the reality is that there's been a change. There's been a huge change. There are so many problems. We have so much to do. But the reality is that at least people now understand.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Joan Dye Gussow. This is Joan Dye Gussow, one of the most important thinkers and writers in nutrition and agriculture, hailed as the matriarch of the Eat Locally, Think Globally food movement, and a teller of difficult truths. Joan Dye Gussow is Professor Emerita and the former chair of the Nutrition Education Program at Columbia University Teachers College, where she has been a long-standing analyst and critic of the U.S. food system. Joan is the author of numerous books, and she has delivered thousands of lectures, speeches, and testimonies. A former art researcher at Time Magazine, Joan is now a celebrated suburban homesteader and currently lives and grows organic produce on the west bank of the Hudson River. Her passion for speaking truth to power and patriarchy paved the way for today's radical farmers, chefs, and those fighting for a just food system. Joan was born in 1928 in Alhambra, California. In 1950, she graduated from Pomona College in Claremont, California, majoring in biology, before moving to New York City, where she landed a job as a researcher at Time Magazine.
During my senior year, I had been a pre-med. I changed to zoology chemistry, so I did not have to take German and physics. I wanted to get married and have children, and I didn't see how you could be a physician and do that. So a chemistry professor of mine knew that I really wanted to be a journalist, and he wrote to Time Magazine and asked if they had any jobs. They wrote back and said they had this training program, but they interviewed for it in Easter vacation, and they would not advise me to come back to be interviewed because, you know, there was a lot of competition and it wasn't worth it. And so he just, without saying anything, just sent all this stuff to me. And I looked at it, and I had gone to San Francisco to look for something in journalism or writing during Easter vacation. And so I just up and decided to go to New York. I got the Rena Gurley Archibald High Scholarship Prize at Pomona, and it was like $75. And so I decided I'd go to New York. And my mother encouraged me because she had come from a little town in Iowa and had been very thwarted in all her desires. She was not going to thwart me. They drove me to the airport. I got on the plane. Took me 22 hours to get to New York. The plane ran out of food, milk, diapers, whatever there was. It was like really amazing. So we got to New York after 22 hours. I went outside, hailed the first taxi I probably ever took in my life. Totally innocent. Really, really innocent. And I remember that the taxi driver, we passed under the 3rd Avenue L, and I said, "What bridge is that?" And he knew then that I was like a total innocent. And he started lecturing me about not going to Central Park by myself, never go at night. He did all this stuff, and we finally got to this woman's apartment. I didn't know her. I was just, you know, had been sent to her, my brother-in-law's ex-girlfriend. And we got to the place, and it was like, I don't know, 113th between Broadway and Amsterdam or something like that. And I tried to get out and coolly give him a tip, and he said, no. He said he parked the cab, he got out, he carried my bags up to the third floor, and he made sure I got in, and he wouldn't even take a tip. And I thought, that has never happened to me since. Never in New York, but it was, like, really very sweet. And so I ended up going to Time, and I got the job. I got a job on the training thing, and it was a great job for a woman in those days, because you were trained, and then you flipped through all the magazines as a trainee, and you went in the clip desk, and you were everywhere, and then you were hired by one of the magazines, either Time, Life, or Fortune. And the saying at the time was, Time researchers sleep by themselves, Life researchers sleep with the photographers, and Fortune researchers sleep with each other. I was hired by Time. Everybody wanted Life. We had Monday and Tuesday for weekends, so I couldn't do weekend things with a lot of people, and so a lot of what I got involved with would be people who had a summer house on Fire Island, and because I was a Monday-Tuesday weekend person, it was great because it was an extra person that they could put up. I guess most of the people I knew at first were from work with the other researchers. That's who I really got to know. And I was very naive. I mean, one of the women, I won't name her, but her father was a theatrical lawyer, and her mother was a producer of some sort, and she had been raised in the kind of society I didn't even know existed. She was the sort of person who could walk into Bergdorf Goodman wearing really crummy clothes and be immediately have people fall all over her, whereas I could dress the best I knew how, go there and be ignored, and I knew immediately that there was something here that I didn't get. So it was interesting. I mean, you know, I was totally sexually naive, so I got inducted by my first boyfriend and felt like I was a slut. And, you know, it was a time when women did not play around, let's put it that way. You know, thought I was going to marry him, and then we fought, and he tried to remake me. He had his own problems, naturally. I went into therapy, naturally. I don't know whether I ever knew who I was by the time I finally met somebody and married them. I met an artist. I ended up in my, maybe 3 or 4 years into my thing, I went to Italy with a friend, and I met then my husband there. He was 3 years younger than I was. I thought he was very immature, and I did not agree to ride on the back of his Lambretta as he would like. But then when I came back from Europe, we had a reporter, correspondent, who had just come back from French Indochina. And we were sitting there having a drink, and this man I'd met in Italy walked in. And we said hello and exchanged whatever. And the next night I went out with somebody who I had known through the fellow that I had gone to Italy to see, this artist. And we went to a place I'd never been before, and I went in, and Alan was sitting at the bar. I mean, two nights in a row we ran into each other accidentally in New York. We had no choice, you know. I ended up marrying him. He was an artist. We were married 40 years. My life in New York was very much shaped, I think, by being with Time, which was a wonderful job for a woman at that point. I became the art researcher. I went out and did interviews with all these artists, and it was an exciting world, even if women were the researchers and men were the writers.
After 7 years at Time magazine and 5 years at home as a wife and mother, Joan Dai-Gussow returned to school to earn her master's and doctorate in nutrition education from Columbia Teachers College.
I've always had the feeling I'm an extraordinarily lucky person. I got married. I grew up in a time when that's what you had to do, right? You have to get married. And I got married late. 28 in those days was late. Had my first child when I was 30. Never grew up feeling that I had to have a career, because I graduated from college in 1950, and I was a pre-med, and I'd actually changed in my senior year to be a zoology chemistry major because I didn't think I could be a physician and have children. It seemed impossible. I didn't know anyone who had a profession who was a woman. And so I didn't really think about having a profession until I was home with two kids and going crazy. We couldn't pay for preschool care. There was none of that. And we didn't have a neighborhood with a lot of kids in it. So I really was with two small boys locked up all winter, and I was going bananas. And when finally they went off to school, a friend who knew I was going bananas introduced me to someone who hired me to do some writing for him. And the evolution was that eventually I decided I had to go back to school. And I went back to school in nutrition because I'd been interested in that since my brother-in-law had sent me Adele Davis's book, Let's Have Healthy Children, when I was pregnant with my son. And I became a fan of Adele Davis, who was at that point sort of considered a faddist by the profession. And so finally I came to the point where people were asking me for advice, and I thought, I don't know enough to do this. You know, I don't know enough, so I'm going back to school and become a nutritionist. So I went back to school and found out that none of the things I was interested in were part of the field. You know, I was interested in additives, and I was interested in population and all that stuff, and that wasn't part of the field. So I was old enough that I was not willing to take no for an answer, in a sense, and I just kind of was given a course to co-teach, and the person didn't get tenure, and I ended up getting the course, and I put it together. And the chairman of the department was so upset because the students all took my course, and they wanted to be advocates. I radicalized them all. I didn't mean to. I was just telling them the truth. What happened was I was very fortunate. I was a good teacher, and I was a good student. I got my degree, and 2 days later, I was made chair of the department for lots of complicated reasons. I knew the head of Teachers College in a social way, and he had always wanted me to be that. He'd coaxed me to come to the program saying, you'll end up being chair of the department, and I, you know. But I was chair of the department. Terribly stressful. Not a recommended career move at all. But what it did was it validated me. In other words, here I was spouting all this stuff about advertising and food, the food supply and all this stuff, which was unheard of for somebody in nutrition. We never said negative things about the food supply. And all the male scientists who dominated the profession looked at me and said, this woman is, you know, crazy. And then, you know, Columbia University made me the chair of a department, so she must not be completely crazy, you know. So it was very, very validating. And there were lots of times I was very upset, very scared, felt very outside, you know, when I became chair. I mean, I knew enough about the nutrition community in New York City to know that I wasn't part of it. Never been a dietitian, never been in a hospital practicing, which is what everybody seemed to do. I think I was very lucky, and I kept getting allowed to do things that other people weren't allowed to do. And I did forge forward, and I did keep telling the truth. But I don't think I had to sacrifice a lot for that. I think I benefited a lot in the end. I love to think, and so I love having a class where students come back and challenge you, but I also love to communicate, and I love to be clear about things. And for me, the important thing is to be totally honest. And there is so much intrinsic dishonesty going on in my profession. I mean, if you look at the Dietetic Association, which renamed itself the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, it takes a special kind of stupidity, I think, to give yourself a name that has the acronym AND. You want to say, and what? You know, they take money from the food industry, and then they never say anything negative about the food industry. I mean, my profession is nutrition education. If you want to know whether nutrition education is successful, look around. I mean, we're a complete failure. We have this huge epidemic of diabetes and obesity, and it's like, come on. Don't you think we ought to really ask ourselves whether the things we're paying attention to are the right things to pay attention to? Don't you think maybe instead of publishing articles on how you structure this particular lesson or these lessons for these children, we ought to think about how we change the goddamn food supply? Don't you think maybe we've missed the whole point? How can we face ourselves as a profession in this society where we're such total failures? It just astonishes me And so I feel like, at least, I'm honest. The students know what I say is what I believe, and I do not pull punches, as you could probably tell. I tell the truth. I look back at things I've written, and I'm very proud. I wrote about how all these new exotic vegetables and fruits were coming on the market, and people were all excited. And I said, why don't we have plenty of vegetables and fruits as it is. We can't get people to eat. What is this all about? It's all about novelty. So maybe what we should do is try to get people to get interested in having a farmer of their own. You know, and I was saying this, you know, I look at that article now and I say, I could have written that yesterday. And I feel pretty good about that. I don't think I was wrong. I think I was way ahead of my time. One of the things I learned early, because I was being challenged by some of the male icons in the profession, was just to confront it. I mean, I would say, somebody would in the audience would say something like, well, one of the guys would say something like, well, such and such and such and such is true, and I'd say, oh, that's interesting. Can you give me a citation for that? And they never had one. They never had one. It was just known, right? And I had gone back sometimes and looked at articles, looked at the citations, checked the citations, gone back to the next citation, and found out they were all quoting each other. So I learned not to have any particular respect for people like that. You know, I'm not good with numbers. I don't spend a lot of time with numbers. I spend a lot of time with logic. And I say to my students, you know, I don't use a lot of numbers because I would have to look them up. If I can't convince you on the basis of reason and logic, then to throw a lot of numbers at you that you're going to have to look up and you're not going to know how to counter is not fair. You know, it doesn't really educate you. You have to challenge me on the basis of, you know, why do you think that, or why have you come to that conclusion? And I wish they did it more, but... The profession, per se, did not have the status that it has now. Food was not on the front pages all the time. Nutrition was not on the front pages. And even dietitians, I think, have more, there's more status in being a dietitian now than there was at the time. At the time, there were an awful lot of like Philippine women that was like their way up to get out was to come and be a dietitian. And the doctors had no respect for them. They basically were slaves, you know, and it was not a wonderful profession. I think now it has more credibility. But the students that I've had in my classes, I would have to say that the biggest difference I noticed over the years was during the Reagan era. During the Reagan era, that message of do for yourself was really, really big. I mean, I can remember the person who was doing student placements for the people in public health saying that one of the people had come to her and said she wanted to work in a health club. And she said, but you're a public health nutritionist. She said, well, that's the public. And there was one of my students who wanted to open a health club on Waikiki, you know, on the beach at Waikiki. They didn't get it. I had a very hard time teaching during that period. But it changed. It changed. And I would say last semester's class was a really terrific group of people. And the world has become very, very difficult with the internet. It used to be that I would be able to say to the students, look, now that you're a nutrition student, you're going to be getting pamphlets every month from the dairy board and the egg board and the whatever board, and they're going to tell you that eggs are wonderful or dairy is wonderful or whatever it is. And, you know, you just have to know that, be skeptical. Now it's really, really hard to arm people against misinformation. I don't really know how we arm people except to say, look at the source. Try to always think about who's saying this. Is their behavior consistent with what they're saying? You know, is Monsanto really feeding the world, or are they really just screwing over farmers, you know? The truths are hard, and so, you know, it's easier for people to just fall into believing that these people are going to solve the problems. But you have to look at their histories. You have to look at where people have come from. You have to look at the fact that not a single person has been able to utter a single negative thing about biotech without having their career ruined. I think that students today should assume that they're living in a time of crisis, that things are going to get worse physically for them and everybody, and that they should try to find some way of making a more just society, whatever that is, because the society that we live in is so growingly unjust and so unfair and so loaded, and so many young black men are just pulled in. I mean, it now turns out that if you have a fight in the schoolyard, they call the police. It's so appalling, and I think what young people should do, particularly young people who are well off enough to be able to take a few chances with money and not earn too much money all the time and not go to Wall Street, is they should try to find a way to make the world more just. And if they're in the food field, they should try to do that with food, and they should try to be as honest as they can and combat the absurdities of the food supply and try to help people learn how to eat well, simply and easily, no matter if it offends the food industry and so forth. Mainly, they should just not be afraid of offending the food industry, which is what's intimidated generations of nutrition students.
Joan's fearlessness in the classroom carried over to her private life as well. After decades of marriage, Joan's husband Alan died of pancreatic cancer, and Joan found herself once again speaking a difficult truth.
My husband's death was a very complicated thing for me because I had been married for 40 years. He had pancreatic cancer, which we knew was a death warrant. I mean, there was no escape from that. And so I had like 5 months of warning once he was diagnosed, because the average length of time from diagnosis to death is 5 months, and that's exactly what it was for him. And I had assumed we had a happy marriage. I used to say to my students who were getting married, I hope you'll be as happy as Alan and I have been, and so forth and so on. And then 2 weeks after he died, I found myself skipping down the street, and I was so upset and stunned and didn't know what to make of it, and spent a very, very long time trying to sort it out. I had a journal. I'd kept a journal more seriously. Once he got sick, I think I started keeping a journal every day. That was probably the first time. But I had some earlier entries from when we bought the house and started working on it. And as I began to confront what I was feeling and be able to even speak about it to friends, really close friends, they'd say, Joan, you have to write about that because nobody writes about that kind of thing. It took me about 10 years, and when I finally got it down, I had 4 chapters. It didn't take that long to say.
Today, Joan can be found working in her garden on the banks of the Hudson, rebuilding her beds after the devastation of Hurricane Sandy, and working on her new book, starting over at 81.
I find having a garden is something that pulls you forward into the future. To have a garden is to have a future, and to have a future is to be alive.
This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research by Sari Kamen and Nathaniel Kober. In order of appearance, the songs used in this piece are Able Fish by Nathaniel Coburn, Cry For Me by the California Honey Drops, Maltese Ice Caves by Space Disease, 4 of 7 by Jack Inslee, I Jam by Knife Show, Jones by Jade, and once again, Able Fish by Nathaniel Coburn.
Finally, we head to the hills of Ireland with Darina Allen, founder of the Ballymaloe Cookery School, a globally recognized epicenter of Gaelic culinary traditions. She is a teacher, author, and television personality, as well as a champion and eloquent spokesperson for the new Irish cuisine.
As a nation, we have grown so much in confidence. I mean, I remember when I was a child, we really, as a nation, most of us had an inferiority complex. We thought that what was in the UK or what was in America or whatever had to be better and more delicious and more sophisticated and more everything than what we had in Ireland. And then gradually, as people, you know, became more affluent, travelled more, I suddenly realised, oh my goodness, you know, what we have in Ireland is amazing. So we now realise that Ireland, as a country, we are blessed by nature and by the good Lord or whatever in terms of food production.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org proudly presents Evolutionaries, Darina Allen. Darina Allen is Ireland's best-known chef and culinary ambassador. She's the founder of Ballymaloe Cookery School, now the country's longest-running cooking school and a globally renowned institution that has hosted and taught some of the world's greatest chefs. In addition, she hosted a cooking television program called Simply Delicious for 9 seasons, which is credited with teaching generations of Irish how to cook and earned her comparisons to Julia Child. She's also written a column for the Irish Examiner since 1998 and is an accomplished author. Darina Allen is a champion of locally grown organic produce and is responsible for starting Ireland's first farmers market. Against all odds, Darina Allen was able to follow her food dreams.
I was educated by Dominican nuns, and that's it. That was the early 60s, lovely Dominicans. So we're always considered to be quite visionary nuns. I was at boarding school for 5 years. And it was coming to the time where, of course, you had to make a decision what you were going to do. And the nuns were very much encouraging us. Now, girls, you'll all need to have a proper career. You know, at that stage, women were just, it was just beginning to be accepted that women should have a career. So a lot of my friends were doing law or architecture or medicine or the sciences or something. And all I really knew anything about from home was cooking or gardening, because my mother was a very good gardener as well. Indeed, my grandfather was too. And I really loved to cook. I just loved cooking. But of course, when I said I wanted to be a chef or a cook, there was sort of this deep intake of breath. Well, certainly not. And I mean, what would you want to learn how to cook for? I mean, or grow? The other thing I thought of was, you know, gardening or something. You know, you're never going to need that, you know, because of course the whole emphasis at that stage was on an academic career. So basically the subliminal message was, well, these practical skills are of much lesser value, and now you're going to be a thoroughly modern woman, you know, you'll have a proper career. So I said, well, really, cooking or growing are the two things that I really seem to be drawn towards. So they said, well, a degree in horticulture, or else you do hotel management. Because remember, at that stage, there was no such chefs, you never heard the name of chefs. The chefs in the top restaurants were men, and women just ran tea shops or little country cafes or something like that. And it was impossible for a woman to get into a top kitchen. So anyway, I enrolled in that wonderful hotel school in Dublin. At that stage, it was called Cahill Brewer Street. And I did hotel and catering management. So that's, and then, of course, at the end of that, I still wanted to cook. I wasn't really particularly interested in the management bit of it at all, really. I just wanted to cook. And I was, again, the same dilemma. I couldn't get into any of the top restaurants because they were, you know, men were chefs. And so I was faced with desperately wanting to learn more. I wanted to learn how to make homemade ice creams, and I wanted to learn more about fresh herbs. This is now the late 60s, 68. And I wanted to learn how to make souffles and terrines and things like that, which sounded so exotic in the 60s. But to get into a top kitchen was really difficult. So I just, by sheer chance, heard about Myrtle Allen, who had farmer's wife down in East Cork, who'd started a restaurant, opened a restaurant in her own house out on a farm in the country, which was considered unheard of at the time. So I, to one of the lecturers in the college, I had told her the sort of thing I was looking for. And she said, well, look, you might try this. And she came back with a name and address on a piece of paper. And the name, and she said, write to this woman. And the name on the piece of paper was Myrtle Allen, who's now my mother-in-law. So I became a member of the family by the simple expedient of marrying the boss's son. That's how it's done. My husband's a horticulturalist. We had 5 acres of greenhouses. We had 65 acres of apples, quite a big apple orchard. This was a commercial horticultural enterprise. We also had mushroom farm then, and it was very successful. It was actually started by my father-in-law, and my husband did a degree in horticulture and inherited the business. But then it employed up to 100 people. There were exported, of course, tomatoes and mushrooms and so on. So it was very important horticulture business in Ireland. But my father-in-law was a great entrepreneur. He would get something started, then he'd jump on to the next thing and so on. So in the late 60s, early 70s, labour costs started to rise. Before that, they really had been, you know, more or less constant. Then there was the oil crisis and 25% inflation. And suddenly, what had been a very successful business was, you know, running really into financial difficulties, and it really needed a huge injection of capital to modernise the greenhouse and all of that. So at the same time, we began to get less and less for our produce. You know, this whole cheap food policy was really kicking in. So it was obvious that the writing was on the wall and we needed to do something else. So we had to look at what talents we had, what resources we had between us. At that stage, we had four small children. We were seriously looking at losing the roof over our heads unless we did something, earned a living in a different way. So we started a farm shop. We stopped growing commercially first. The mushroom farm was closed down. This was all very traumatic when we were a young married couple. Then we pulled out some of the orchards. And then also decided to go out of commercial production of tomatoes and just kept 1 acre of greenhouses. Then we started a farm shop on the farm, and that was very successful. We did it for about 3 years and we made some money, but not really enough to justify the work we were doing. It was a 7 day week. We had four small children, so there was a real, you know, we were working so hard.
With the farm business failing, Darina and her husband Tim were desperate for a way to keep their dreams alive. What happened next would eventually lead to the iconic Ballymaloe cooking school.
At that stage, Myrtle, my mother-in-law, in the winters, she would decided to give some cooking classes in Ballymaloe when the bedrooms weren't very busy. So, and I would help her. I was helping in the kitchen a little bit. She then decided, if you don't mind, to start a restaurant in Paris as a showcase for Irish food called La Ferme Irlandaise, which was very successful, but it never really made money, but it continued for many years. But in the meantime, there was I back in Shanagarry, and people were still ringing up looking for cooking classes. So Myrtle said, why don't you do them? And I thought, well, nobody's going to come and see me, because it was really Myrtle Allen's name that was known and was famous. But I had been assisting her, and we really needed the money. And she said, look, I think you should go ahead. So I put an ad in the local newspaper, the Cork Examiner, and started a little series of courses on Saturday mornings. People came, and some of the Ballymaloe customers came who wanted to find out how to do some of the dishes that they loved at Ballymaloe. They came in their little mink jackets out of Cork and in little lovely great big cars, and we hid our rusty Renault 4L around the back. And then, of course, anything like that you do the first time is always the most difficult. And then if you get through the first time, people say, well, that was great. Then it gives you more confidence and on. So I did that for a couple of years. And then a friend of mine said, look, why don't you start a residential cooking school in Ireland? I think you could do this, because basically people are going to the Cordon Bleu in London or Paris or something. And so I thought, well, maybe. And then in the meantime, I'd heard about Italian food. Now, this is in the late 70s. And I was desperate to learn a bit more about Italian food. And, you know, it seems ridiculous now to think that it was such a mystery, but I'd been making pasta, homemade pasta, and in my kitchen at home and drawn for that. And then, as luck would have it, Jane Montong, who was the food editor of Gourmet magazine, came and stayed in Ballymaloe. And Myrtle, my mother-in-law, said to her, look, Darina really would love to learn more about Italian food. Where should she go? And Myrtle said, well, there's only one person, and that's Marcella Hazan. And she has a cooking school in Bologna. So she sent me, when she went back, she sent me Marcella Hazan's address. I wrote to her. Of course, it was all snail mail at that time. And I got back this little simple brochure about a week in, you know, Bologna. And that was the first, Marcella was one of the first people to actually do this combination of cooking classes and visits to markets and vineyards and cheesemakers and all of that. And it was $650, I think. It must have been dollars, wasn't it, at that time. And this is in 1980, I'd say, 1980, 81. But because I'd been working so hard and because I wanted to do this with the farm shop, my husband, when he knew how much I wanted to go, he literally spent the last money we had, gave me a present of Marcella Hazan's course. So I went off to Bologna, to my first time to Italy, down on the train from Paris, to Marcella's course, and I loved it. And Marcella and Victor were so lovely and fascinated. They wondered how on earth I got an Irish farmer's wife, because I was just an Irish farmer's wife at that stage. Something very interesting happened that week. I'd heard about how amazing Italian food was and how fantastic the food in the markets and everything was, how fantastic the fish was. And yet the food was delicious, but suddenly I realised, well, it's not any more delicious than what we have at home in our own gardens, in the greenhouses, etc. And it was the real eureka moment. Was one, there was a great build-up to this farewell dinner in Cesenatico, which was actually Marcella's hometown, and we were going to have this seafood dinner. I still remember the name of the restaurant. It was called La Gambera, I think, which I think means the shrimp or something, or the prawn. And it was out on stilts, literally on the beach. And we did indeed have a delicious dinner, wonderful fresh seafood. But suddenly I thought, wow, these prawns and this fish is not any better than the beautiful fresh fish we get in from the boats in Manicotton. And then I suddenly realised that the answer to our earning a living in a different way was right under my nose. We were at home, in the middle of a farm, growing a huge variety of produce, even at that time, because we had, of course, all the vegetables and herbs, and we had an acre of greenhouse still. And we were right beside the sea with wonderful fish coming in from the boats in Ballycotton. Ballymaloe House, the restaurant and the inn, as you would call it, was already established with a whole network of small producers. So I thought it was like a ding sort of moment where you'd think, what am I thinking about? The answer is right under my nose. We have to start a cooking school in the middle of the farm, the gardens. We have the produce there. We have the hens. We have the chickens. Of course, I went home and we opened the Ballymaloe Cookery School in September 1983. So we're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. What I did was, before I opened the cooking school, I actually went to five of what I reckoned were the top cooking schools in the UK, the Cordon Bleu, Top Marie's in Woking, and Prue Leeds, etc. And I did a class in each one, also to just see what they were doing, what their standard was, etc. Just in a way that gives you confidence, you know. And then I looked at what they were charging. So, and the Cordon Bleu in London, the Cordon Bleu in Paris, and so on. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do a cooking school, it has to be as good as anything anywhere in the world. And why can't it be? We're in the middle of, this sounds all very whatever, but that was how I thought. I thought, we're in the middle of a farm, we've fabulous produce, we can really do a good job. And so I just charged the same as they did, which was a bit cheeky, actually, when I was just starting off. But I thought, what I want to do, I think if you're starting a business, there's a couple of things that are really important. One is to charge enough so you can do a good job. So I didn't want to be in a position where if somebody burnt something that, you know, you thought, oh, well, I can't give them more ingredients because, you know, it's going to cut my margin. And anyway, I've never really done anything just for money. It's sort of, in a way, it's great. You have to make money to keep a business going, to pay your staff, to keep the show on the road. But money has never been the sole reason for me doing something. It's sort of a sort of greater passion in some ways. The other thing that I've always felt is a lot of marketing and advertising and everything promises the world, but usually does not deliver. So our sort of kind of way we do it is to promise less and give more. So that very often when people come, they think, oh my goodness, this is, you know, the perception sometimes is, well, this is quite expensive. But when people are leaving, they feel that they've at the very least got value for money and usually much, much more. So that's what we very much aim for, and that they think, oh, I can't wait to come back. The other thing that I suddenly realised when I started the school was, oh, now I could have some guest teachers. So I can, all my heroes, I thought, well, I can ask them, will they come and teach at the cooking school? I wonder, will they come to Ireland? Will they like that? So one of the first people I picked up the phone to was Marta Jeffrey. And, you know, you laugh at this now, but at that stage, I was so intimidated by making a phone call to America. I got her phone number, I think, through Gourmet magazine, and I picked up the phone, rang her, and got straight through to her, actually. And at that stage, it was March 86, and Gourmet magazine, believe it or not, had come and done a cover story about the cooking school. It was the first cooking school in the world they'd written about, amazingly. When I picked up the phone and rang Marta, she apparently had just read the Gourmet magazine, and suddenly I'm on the end of the phone. I'm saying, I have a little cooking school in Ireland. I wonder whether I could tempt you to come over and teach a guest chef's class. And she said, are you Ballymaloe? And I said, yes. And she said, I'd love to. I couldn't believe it. I got off the phone. I went, yoo! Like what they say, punching the air nowadays. So, and then I had Jane Grigson and Claudia Roden, of course, and Data Chang. And so through the years, it's like a who's who of the food world, really. The people who came and teach it, taught at the school.
After finding great success with the Ballymaloe Cooking School, Darina Allen had another eureka moment. This time, it would lead her to start Ireland's very first farmer's market.
Yes, I did start the first farmer's market in Ireland, and that came about because I was visiting a friend in San Francisco, Mary Risley, who, by the way, has a cooking school called Tante Marie's in San Francisco, and I was staying with her, and she remembered coming in late at night, and she said, well, look, we won't stay up too late because I want to take you to this farmer's market that started at the other side of town in a parking lot. I think you might be very interested in it. And I said, oh, Mary, I'm not getting up at like 7 o'clock in the morning tomorrow morning. But she's even bossier than I am. Anyway, she traipsed me out to this farmer's market that was in a parking lot at the other side of town at that stage. And this was another eureka moment for me, because at that time in Ireland, the supermarket system was really becoming established, and a lot of the supermarkets had gone over to a central distribution system. So what would happen was that local farmers would send their potatoes or carrots or, you know, whatever it was, their beef or whatever, to a central distribution store in Dublin, where so everything went up to the main cities and then was distributed back out to the supermarkets around the country. So suddenly local shops, many of them which were owned by supermarkets at that time, were suddenly told that they couldn't sell local food, or they would be almost penalised if they bought more than 2% of local produce. So people who were sort of selling potatoes or carrots or cabbages into a local shop suddenly were told, well, I'm sorry, we can't buy from you any longer because we have to buy from central distribution, from the head office. So this was happening. So suddenly local people, local farmers couldn't sell to the ordinary local shop system that they had been doing for generations, and local people couldn't get local food. So this was kind of in the background, this was happening, and here I am, bleary-eyed at 7:15 in the morning in this parking lot in San Francisco, and I suddenly think, oh my God, if we could get the market system re-established in Ireland, local people, local farmers could sell to local people and local people could get the local food again. Otherwise, they can't meet. There were farmers in desperation to sell their produce on one side, local people in desperation to get it at the other side. But most people haven't got time to go directly to farms to buy. So I came home all fired up, and I started the first farmers market in Ireland on the Coal Quay in Cork, where there'd been at that stage a market for over 400 years. At that stage, I was on television with my Simply Delicious series. I realised the importance of, I wanted to, but of doing it myself too. So when people saw somebody who was on television, you know, a sort of celebrity in inverted commas at that stage, you know, setting up with another five or six people on the side of the street in Cork, a market, they, you know, got quite a lot of publicity, incredulous publicity. And so that was the beginning of the farmers market movement. Now there are over 160 farmers markets in Ireland. My son-in-law, Rupert Hugh Jones, actually runs two farmers markets outside Cork as well, called Douglas and Mahon Point, who are award-winning farmers markets. So this is, of all the little things I've been involved in my career, you might say, in inverted commas, this is the thing I'm most proud of actually having restarted the farmers markets, which has made such a difference to so many people's lives. I mean, so many farmers have come and said to me, I wouldn't still be on the land if it wasn't for you. And I mean, how wonderful is that?
These days, Darina has been putting a lot of attention on young mothers and providing proper nutrition for children.
One of the things that's been really concerning me more and more in the last number of years, now of course that I have grandchildren myself as well, I've got nine grandchildren at this stage, we're doing our bit for our country, but is basically, you know, young mothers who seem terrified and confused by all the conflicting information they're getting. And if you're not eating well yourself, that a baby and a toddler will want to eat the same food. I mean, genes being what they are, they love the same food, the kind of foods that you love yourself. So there's no point in a mother who's not, if a mother is not eating well herself, or if there's a lot of food in the house that, you know, fast food and that kind of thing. I mean, again, my own grandchildren, they're not particularly different than anything else. It's just that we live in the middle of an organic farm and we have a greenhouse. We grow a lot of things ourselves. So they, you know, they go into the greenhouse and they'll literally will eat kale off the plants. You know, they eat the little Romanesco and broccoli and they call them Christmas trees, you know. So they don't know any different. That's just their norm. And I've just come back from India. And of course, the little babies in India, what do they eat? They eat dal, they eat some spicy food. They don't necessarily have chili until their second or third year. But that's the mothers, that's the food the mothers eat, so that's what they eat. If you're in Mexico, again, it'll be the sort of Mexican food. If you love lentils, like what my daughter does, well, then the baby will love lentils. So, you know, we are so fortunate in a way, my generation, I'm now 66 years of age, I think. And no, I'm sorry, I'm 65, actually. But anyway, we are all living on inherited good health from our ancestors. We are what we are because what of our mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers at all ate. And so they passed us down this gift of health from eating simple, nourishing food. So in a way, one really worries about that, you know, this generation in many, many cases is not passing on this health to their children, grandchildren. Of course, it doesn't just start when the baby is born. There's nothing new under the sun, but it's just a question of nowadays we get so much of our information from the television and from, you know, really aggressive marketing that it's to stop for a second and think, well, look, the world survived to this point in time, you know, so how was it done before all these products and everything were available? And if you can possibly manage to keep away from them totally, and it's difficult, people are very, very busy, young mothers very often are actually keeping down a job as well as looking after children. I just think they're heroes. I can't imagine how it's done, really, and they're under financial pressure. So anything one can do to give them more confidence in their own instincts is really worthwhile.
Jarena Allen continues to question how we eat and grow our food, both in Ireland and globally, and works tirelessly to spread the good word of good food across the world. This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research and assistance from Talia Ralph. The songs used in this piece in order of appearance are Radio Ra by Obesity, Dawn by Jerome LOL, Running Like a Ghost by Shadowbox, Every Man's Balance by Comanche, Dirty Hands by Eula, Let's Not by Shadowbox, Kodachrome by Comanche, and again, Rara by Obesity.
For full Evolutionaries episodes, visit heritageradionetwork.org or search for us on iTunes and Stitcher. This is Elizabeth Sachs reporting for heritageradionetwork.org.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.